Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson. And today, we are pleased to welcome back Bob Fitzwilson, founder and managing partner of the Portola Group, one of the financial advisory groups we endorse here at Peak Prosperity. Now, I've invited Bob to join us again to share his expertise on how the average investor can design a portfolio around the 3E forces identified in the crash course, something Bob is going to call, I believe, the sustainable portfolio. As mentioned on my prior podcast with Bob, there is a business relationship between his firm and Peak Prosperity, the details of which are clearly spelled out in the write-up accompanying this article. So, hey, Bob, I'm really interested to explore your sustainable portfolio concept on behalf of our listeners. Thanks so much for coming back on the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me back.
You know, we really didn't have a whole lot of time to dig into this concept of portfolios, portfolio allocation. I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about that, in particular, very interestingly, how the three E's in the environment, energy, and the economy, how all three of these we might build a portfolio that's really sustainable or durable, we might say, in this age. So let's start all the way at the beginning and give listeners an idea of what's your approach to portfolio allocation.
Well, it actually gave me some good thoughts that I hadn't had before. You know, I think I mentioned the last time that I had written software that calculates how much is enough, for example. And I needed the software because it's a hugely complicated problem. But so in thinking about today, I broke out sustainability into two pieces. One is sustainability of lifestyle and wishes, and the other is sustainability of the portfolio. So if we take out the inflation and the rate of return components to the problem, it's pretty simple. It's just really adding up what your desired real lifestyle would be over your life expectancy, along with wishes. I mean, some people have wishes to make charitable contributions and gift to kids, but if we hold the inflation and the rate of return assumptions at zero, it's really just adding up the numbers over what you consider your life expectancy, and that's the amount of money you need. You know, we have this sophisticated technology, but for the average person, you know, they can certainly begin the process by just making those calculations. So if I'm going to spend, you know, $200,000 over the rest of my life, then, and my life expectancy is 10 years, I know how much money I have to squirrel away or have coming in.
Yep.
It gets a little more complicated when you talk about rates of return and also particularly inflation. What we use in our model and have for 32 years is 3 to 5%, and I think we touched on that in the first interview. And so 3 to 5% is the real rate of return to sustain the real value of the lifestyle. So if I had, you know, $100 million and I needed $200,000, then sustaining the real value of my portfolio is not an issue, and I probably don't need to worry about rate of return and inflation, at least runaway inflation.
Yep.
But if I want to maintain the total value, I've got to factor those in too.
Right. So this lifestyle and wishes, that sounded easy enough, right? You just, there's some numbers, but then you have all these moving pieces that have to be accounted for. So in the portfolio, I guess you're saying the first decision here is what are your goals? Where are you trying to get to? Where are you today? That sounds pretty classic. Of these moving pieces you mentioned before, there are a lot of them, right? We've got the two you mentioned, rate of return plus inflation. So one a gain, one eating into our potential real returns. And then what else? Taxes?
Right.
You know, I guess lots of other complexities in people's lives depending on relatives they might have or circumstances or different holdings. So lots of pieces there. And you felt you had to develop a program to sort of manage all those pieces, I understand.
Because the 3 to 5% is after tax and inflation. Because, you know, nobody knows what inflation is going to be and nobody knows what taxes are going to be. So it's really sort of a leap of faith that there will be some real rate of return out there.
Well, especially these days, do you think that's realistic?
It's hard to, we know that, you know, in our view at least, inflation is going to go way up and we know that taxes are going to go way up. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me to see taxes double, in a very short period of time. And that's not just income taxes, that's across the board. Because, you know, governments are broke. And so, we come, our main office is in California, and you know, the state government's broke. A lot of the cities are going bankrupt, and you know, the classic way for them to gain revenues is through property taxes. So I suspect that those are going to be going up too. The reason why I broke it out into sustain what is that I think people get confused about sustaining the nominal and even the real value of their portfolio without thinking about relating to them personally and their family. Because if you really have, you know, I'm picking silly numbers, but let's say you do have $100 million and you need $200,000. You shouldn't focus your time probably on maintaining or increasing the real value of it, unless that's your avocation. You should focus on nailing down the family and the lifestyle issues, and just making sure you don't. You can go to $200,000. So one is really a portfolio question, and I find most people that I talk to are focused on the portfolio side, and I try to get them to focus on the life issues and their family issues.
And meaning not just in the future, but today as well?
Yeah, because you know, I've always been somewhat of an existentialist about this money stuff, and you know, there is an end to it, and so it's not that we just live forever and accumulate forever. And so I think people need, with all the TV and the internet and data coming in and opinions, people, I think, get defocused too much to the portfolio issues instead of really saying, okay, I've got a family, or I'm an individual. What are my needs? What do I have to sustain and for how long? And that should be sort of their base case first.
Sure. I as well, over here at Peak Prosperity, very interested in having people understand that some of the best investments that exist right now are in yourself, your homestead, your current living situation, and that I always have an eye towards the idea that I'm not socking away money so that I can enjoy myself in the future. I'm going to enjoy myself today, first and foremost, and in the future too, I hope. So making sure that my own existential approach is really lined up, making sure for me, I really care that I'm living well and in accordance with my beliefs and principles today and tomorrow too, if I can afford it. So is that
completely agree.
Part of what you're thinking about there?
Yeah, no, because it just in my career, it's gone from Value Line and Ben Graham to futures and options and puts and calls and Forex and all this stuff. And so people, I think, are getting wrapped up in what they see instead of coming back to themselves and their family. And, you know, for example, I had a question this week about paying down their mortgage, and this person was getting a distribution from an investment, and I said, you know, that's not a bad idea, because, you know, if you're paying 5 or 6% on your mortgage, that's a certain 5 or 6% cost versus, let's say, an uncertain 8 to 10%. You know, you can argue about whether, you know, that's out of line, which it probably is. So paying down your mortgage is like making a great investment. And it also aids in the sustainability, because the last thing you want to do is to stock up your apartment, your house, your farm, whatever, and have the property tax man and the sheriff come and take it all away from you.
Absolutely. So what do you mean then by what's a sustainable portfolio?
Well, again, I'd start first with what do I need to do to sustain the base case, my lifestyle and wishes for my family. Then you go up the ladder, and if you're talking about sustaining the nominal value and then the after-tax and inflation value. So to generate 3 to 5% returns, I mean, there's virtually no income anymore. So to generate 3 to 5% returns longer term, you're going to have to be in some form of equity, and I would include real estate, and private companies, and businesses in general. So if the goal is the whole tuna about not only the lifestyle but also the value of the portfolio, you're going to have to be in some form of equities. And I find a lot of people have been investing in adjectives. They're in small cap and big cap and all this stuff, but they really don't know what they own. And you know, the master investors throughout my lifetime and all the ones I've read about were people that identified businesses that had great long-term prospects, and then they tried to hold on to it for as long as they can. People are disparaging buy and hold, and yet if you look at the Forbes 400 or whatever the number is now, virtually all those people were people that bought and hold, whether it was a private company or a public company. So I think people need to, we touched on this a little bit, people need to go back to investing instead of speculating. Because if they're in the speculative side, you're going to lose because you're playing against people with huge money, computers, billions of a second strategies, and it's really destructive. So I think to sustain your portfolio, you've got to find the businesses, and there are plenty of them around the world that are doing old-fashioned things, growing sales, earnings, things like that, providing a good product, not damaging the environment.
Yeah, it's interesting that there are so many parts about stocks that, and investing in stocks or speculating in stocks, seems to run counter to almost all of our other experiences in life. Stocks are one of the few things you can find that the more expensive they get, the more people want them, and the cheaper they get, the less they want them.
Right.
That's an oddity. But it's when you say people are investing in adjectives, big cap, small cap, all that, it's almost as if, like if I looked at my graduating high school class, I would never just say, oh, I've put my money on all the people in homeroom number 8. That's where I decided to put my money, over there in the small cap world. I would personally never just think about giving money equally out to an entire collection of people if I knew them, right? I would say, no, I think this person's got a much better chance of doing something awesome in terms of building a productive business or being careful and clever with this money. And the same is true when I was learning investing from my grandfather. He every single investment was a real moment for him. He would tear apart the financial statements. If he didn't know the people in the company, he would try and call people who knew them. He wanted to find out, did they know what they were doing? Could they differentiate? You know, value stuff, right? Standard fundamental analysis. And so in your mind, then, a sustainable portfolio is cognizant of the idea that there are still values to be had out there. That's a truism that's just as true today, perhaps, as it was back in Graham and Dodd's day, or maybe forever, that there will be some relative winners and losers, and you don't want to just sort of cast your money blindly across that landscape. Is that getting to the heart of it somewhat?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the environment is more of what you don't want to invest in. I mean, the people who are harming the environment, doing bad things. So, you know, the one that's always been sort of the poster child for me is tobacco. You know, it's a great business, and most people own a piece of the tobacco industry. They just don't know it. It's done through their retirement plans. But for me, that's just, I don't care what the economics are. It's just doing something that I don't like. That's just me. Mm-hmm. And so, and then on the positive side, you've got people like Whole Foods that are trying to promote local farmers and pesticide-free, things like that. So it's kind of those two things, the things that you don't want to encourage and the people that you do. The rest of it is about opportunity. Energy, as much as a problem energy is, if you flip your thinking, it's a huge opportunity. You know, everybody has different views about which form of energy, but we know that the cost of energy is going up, and so if I were just starting in business, I that would be a kid in a candy store time. Because it's a huge amount of money, and there's going to be great fortunes made in solving those issues. As far as the economy in general, the old wisdom is just as valid today as it always was. I mean, Peter Lynch certainly is one of the top 5 investors in history, and he was real straightforward. He said, just go to the shopping mall and see what people are buying.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the strongest message I could transmit to people is get away from the adjectives, get away from the speculation, and just use your head and read. Read about what companies are doing good things and try to find those and invest them. It doesn't have to be just public companies. It can be private companies if you have access to that, or start a private business.
Right. So we're investing in things that we believe in, obviously, and understand, hopefully, and that there are lots of opportunities out there. And one opportunity is, I know a lot of people struggle with this first sort of bifurcation. I'm going to put some money in holding X and holding Y. Holding X might be their actual stock portfolio. Holding Y, let's call this their homestead, themselves, their own residence, what have you. How would you coach somebody or counsel somebody to go about figuring out how much to invest on a percentage basis here versus there?
Well, you know, you've helped to guide me in reverse of what I was thinking when I started this journey. You know, in the beginning, you're thinking about your money and how do I sustain that? And again, it could be sustaining my lifestyle, or it could be sustaining and growing the nominal value. But you know, after I learned about your findings, I realized that what you have to sustain first is yourself and your family. Mm-hmm. And so I would start first with that. And whether you're living in an apartment or you've got a ranch or what have you, it's really looking around yourself and saying, what is it that I rely on? And I've done this for 3 years. I say, what is it I assume I have, whether it's food or energy or gas or what have you, telephone, and then say, what would I do if I didn't have that? And so to me, that's the ultimate in sustainability, and it's really the core of what people should be doing. The money part of it is really the end of the process, where you have something left over mm-hmm. after taking care of these life issues, and then you can build a portfolio that will, you know, going back to what we first opened up with, it's really a continuum from sustainability. It's at the bottom of the continuum is my life, and at the top of the continuum is that I want to have unlimited money, and so everybody can pick and choose where they want to be on that timeline, but that's on top of taking care of your health and your food and safety and things like that.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And there are extraordinary and very good and very tangible returns that come out of that. One just is their financial returns that we can easily catalog. So my utility bill used to be this much. Now it's only that much. And I can see the return I'm getting off of whatever improvements I made to make that happen. And then some things we can do are just are what I call, instead of it's adoption versus adaption. Adopting is we're going to take on some new technology. So or some new process. Adapting is just sort of changing our behaviors a little bit, in the face of things. And turns out, there are some very simple adaptions, don't really take that much out of our lives or require that huge of a change, which can make very big differences. If we've had children, we've all attempted to get them to turn off lights after they leave a room and things like that. Simple adaption strategies. Now, you're out there in California, and I see premium gasoline maybe in your neck of the woods is encroaching on $5 a gallon. Are you noticing, is this creating any detectable waves for people out there yet in terms of saying, here's some clues that I might have to start organizing my life a little bit differently?
Well, I know it's generating a great deal of hostility.
Yeah.
Because that's probably the one thing, because if you increase taxes, the impact falls on different people, but you increase the cost of gas and it hits everybody.
Right.
And it hits your entire budget, your ability to, go out to dinner, all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, it came virtually overnight. But I think it's a good shot across the bow for everybody that this is what can happen, and it probably will happen. And so people need to change their behavior. And so, you know, it's certainly impacting my company and me. You know, people are driving less and telling people if you can work at home and get your job done, you should do that. And so, financially, in the short term, it's not a good thing for people. But I think in the long term, it's just giving them a glimpse of what the future holds.
Absolutely. And that wake-up call, you know, speaking of sort of wake-up calls, we just had an earthquake here a couple nights ago that I felt. And so I think now I've felt more in the past year than Adam has, and that's kind of weird because he's up in Northern California too. And it's clearly an idea of what it raised for me was this idea that things just, it's a great wake-up call that sometimes the unexpected things do happen. And I know that in your planning software, which I'd like to talk about a little more, there's a lot of what ifs in there. You know, you mentioned to get a sustainable portfolio, there's a few big moving pieces you can nail down pretty easily. But it turns out there's a lot of complexity that can get baked into things, including the unknown, the unexpected. We didn't expect gas to shoot up to $5 a gallon, didn't expect this earthquake the other night. Hey, that's life. These things do happen. So how do you help people plan for the unknowns?
Well, the software took me about 4 years to do because there are these so many variables, so many unknowns. But basically what it does, it takes all the various aspects of a person or a family, and we put that into the software, and then it organizes itself by topic. So there's, you know, the traditional balance sheet and cash flow, but there's also the question that almost everybody wants to know is, do I have enough money?
Mm-hmm.
And so that the software, it makes it easy to address these issues. It's kind of like having an architect draft up a set of plans. And so we like to believe that it gives the person control and, well, first of all, clarity about where they are. And most people have no clarity. They just get a brokerage statement. There's all these adjectives, and they have no idea where they really stand. And so one of the benefits of the software is it gives them clarity about all these life issues and then control. Because, you know, the standard financial advisor is going to, they use rules of thumb. But, you know, I tell people that whatever path we choose is going to be about you, not about me. And so I like to believe that with this software, it gives people control so they can make informed judgments about the impact of their decisions. And then because it's very granular, you can literally change how much you spend on gas, and it will tell you how it affects your ability to retire 30 years from now.
Hmm.
So it's a very powerful tool.
What are the kinds of things that sort of pop up as maybe learnings or surprising findings for people when you run this process?
Well, the most interesting recently has been that people are outspending their money.
Uh-huh.
You know, the 90s, particularly in the Silicon Valley, were pretty heady, and people made a lot of money, but they retired. You know, for a long time, the big contest was to see who could retire at the earliest age.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is a lot of people did that, and what I'm finding is a lot of people are either have outrun their money or are getting close. And, you know, one of the reasons I created the software in the first place was for a person that did that. It was a great deal of money to start, but then a horrendous expense level. And so I wanted a way to show them the impact of their choices. But despite that, they continued to run it down to zero. And what I'm finding lately is, certainly in Silicon Valley, is that even people that had a lot of money are, and maybe because they haven't had software like this to help them make better choices, is they're running out of money. A lot of people have viewed their home equity as their safety valve, and we know that's been under fire. And so I, particularly for the people who are in the 65 and up age range, they're hitting a brick wall and being forced to look at their home equity as a source of liquidity, which they didn't want to do. So at least with the software and the process, we can at least people give the clarity, and then ultimately their choices are about them.
So if I sat down with you or we did this over, is this something we could do over the phone? I haven't been through the planning process, so I'm just wondering what's entailed. What, just walk me through the process.
Yeah, the beauty of it is that it really needs three pieces of information: a name, a birth date, and one asset or liability. Because so think of it as sort of this cloud that, as you put in data, it pops up insights. You know, like what's my net worth? How much do I spend? When can I retire? And the beauty of it is that you can start with just those three pieces of information. But as you put more and more information into it, the insights get better and better. And once you get all the information in and it's accurate, then the insights are superb. And so it's sort of like having a financial dashboard. And even if you're 20 years old, it tells you, so if your goal is to retire when you're 30, it'll tell you what you have to do. You know, when Google went public, there were unhappy holders of the stock because the stockbroker who had the initial shot at providing the advice addressed it as a stock. So Google at 200, they perhaps correctly argued that it was ahead of itself, and so they sold it. But what you should do is start with the architecting and the lifestyle issues. And so, for example, if, again, picking silly numbers, if my expenses were $1 million a month and I had 10 million, if you looked at the 10 million in Google, you'd want to tell people to sell and diversify. But if you looked at my lifestyle, you'd know that I had to stay in there and speculate. Modeling it this way gives people clarity about when to sell their stock, when to sell their business, when to sell their vineyard, you know, what sort of price you need. Because can I make gifts to charity? How much can I give to charity? You know, one of the things that I sort of wanted to bring up is, as you know, I had a pretty deadly bout with cancer. You know, despite being the closet existentialist, when you're facing the end, it clarifies things. And mm-hmm. so one of the things it taught me is that there is an end. And so you want to be proactive. You want to have a great life and do proactive planning, but you just never know. I was 57 at the time. So it's given me a greater emphasis with people to really address these issues and say, okay, how do you want to play out your life expectancy is, and what do you want to have happen? And that's different than, what's Google going to do, or, what's your rate of return? So it's very much addressing the family issues, and having the cancer really brought that to the forefront.
Yeah, I imagine it did. How long ago was that now?
It started in 06, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, late 05. But I probably survived more out of ignorance than anything else. I just, it just wasn't going to happen. But it was a very swift and deadly form of cancer. And so you go from being this person who is identified by, your family and your assets and your business and all that stuff, and within 30 days, it's over.
Mm. Yeah.
Obviously, unfortunately, it wasn't over, but I got the message.
Oh, and then a profound message. And I think we're all receiving a version of that message, which is saying that we're on an unsustainable course, and so there is a change coming. And it turns out, I think, with the positive side of something like a bout with cancer or a scare with cancer or any sort of big life event like that, is it gives you the opportunity to step back and go, hey, what's really important? And it turns out often that nose to the grindstone, the things we occupy ourselves with, I know this is true for me, aren't always the most important things. And this is a great time for people to really line up where they are in life, where they want to go, where the world is headed, what their own actions are, where their investments are lined up, given the things we know. And my hypothesis is this is an extraordinary time to be alive. There's lots we can do. There are a lot of opportunities, and there are some major pitfalls. The biggest pitfalls tend to be the oldest ones in the book. You can read about these. I know you're a student of history. I was in your office. I saw all the books. A really impressive collection going back to several thousand years BC, I believe. And the oldest pitfall of them all is that we think what we think we know turns out not to be true. It's the hubris of empire. It's thinking that our whatever we've built for ourselves is permanent. It's that idea of permanence that what we've constructed is both inviolable and unchanging. And guess what? It always changes. So here we are, and we've got, I think, some really obvious signs coming from all over the economic landscape, the energy field, the environment as well. All three are telling us the same thing, which is time to really understand what's happening and be as proactive as you can be, given the uncertainties involved. And so with all that, I mean, is there anything else that we can talk about around how you would... I know in our first interview, in case somebody listening now didn't listen to that, you talked about how you believe there are big trends in play and that these offer great opportunities to position money for whatever might be coming. And those were in... You felt they were in technology. It was in energy and water. And what else did you have? In food. Yep.
I guess my central message is that there's too much handicapping about how the financial crisis and the fiscal cliff are going to work out. Ultimately, I mean, it's interesting, and, we're all supposed to think about that, but ultimately it comes down to you as a person or you as a family. And so what you need to do is batten down the hatches and think about sustainability issues at a personal level and try and build a sustainable investment portfolio, and then get out there and every day just take advantage of all these opportunities that are coming our way.
That's it. Invest in yourself. Find out what the ways that you can invest in, either reducing a mortgage that's got a rate of interest that's higher than anything you could conceivably earn in a risk-free basis on the outside world. Invest in infrastructure improvements that will lower your food and energy bill, maybe even give you better quality food at the same time that it's costing you less, these sorts of things. And then money left over. Now you have to really think about all these other opportunities that are out there, and there are a lot of them. There are a lot of them. I guess you've been doing reasonably well in these past few months in the investments. And well, let me get your sense on this going forward. How do you feel about where we are in the markets and how you can control for whatever risks might be out there?
So I see two time frames. One time frame is that things are set up for chaos. A lot of people, there are too many people that think they're in control of everything. They view life as a machine with a lever, and it just doesn't work that way. So as investors, we've identified who did it, how we got here, what's the history, what's the allocation. But for the next 6 months, it's really just paying very close attention and trying to be flexible. On a longer-term basis, it's not only taking advantage of the opportunity, but also the changes that you've identified. So if peak oil is in our future, we know prices are going up. I just saw a chart yesterday of the drilling rig count in Saudi Arabia, and it was straight up, but the production was doing a button hook to the downside. And so the fellow that sent me the chart, I said, that looks like desperation. he said, yep. So for the short term, everybody needs to be extremely cautious, and we describe our approach sort of like a tortoise. We've got 60-70% of the assets under the shell, but you have to look for opportunities. So the other 30%, keep your eyes open, but be ready to put everything under the shell if things get out of control, and that potential exists in the next 6 months. But after that, it's just really common sense, you know. What do people need? I think your comments about local businesses are right on. So if I were starting a business, it'd be local, it'd be high quality, it'd be high service, low energy input, good for the environment, all that sort of stuff. And there's an unlimited opportunity everywhere probably in the planet for something like that.
Oh, absolutely. And the good news is there are a lot of people experimenting with and being successful in these models, and there's a lot of energy for people who want to buy local and do good things for the environment at the same time. And guess what? All of this is possible. We just have to sometimes shift our mindset a little bit. And what I was talking with you about before we started recording was the trip over to the UK and noting that it's very easy to run into what I call the dominant paradigm mindset. People who are of the opinion of saying, you know, humans have faced difficulties before. This looks like a difficult period. We're going to get right through it. And my answer to that is, of course we will. In 1,000 years, there will be people right here where I am, eating, drinking, playing, and laughing and doing all that wonderful stuff. Maybe with a whole different set of opportunities, though, and maybe with an entirely transformed landscape. I can't predict at all what that's going to look like. But I think a really robust assumption to be carrying here is that whatever the most recent trend has been in terms of development and progress, that's just a one-way trip. There's lots of examples from all over the world that say, nope, it goes in fits and starts. You know, Europe under the Romans was vastly more advanced in terms of architecture, infrastructure, all kinds of things than it was in the hundreds of years after they left. These things ebb and flow. So great time to understand what is ebbing, what's flowing. And as you mentioned, some of this stuff is just, it's common sense. You know, you look at where we are in the water story or the energy story or the food story, and there's just really obvious trends there that are going to be, in my estimation, extraordinarily resistant or even immune to any sort of technological changes we might make. Because guess what? Once you lose all the topsoil, your technology's kind of, I don't care how good of a tractor you've got, doesn't really matter.
Well, we also had a great example this week of the man that jumped out of the balloon at 24 miles.
Yes.
You know, nobody knew who the fellow was before, and, you know, he may have just changed an aspect of technology and space exploration by his courage, and that's the way progress comes about, by something unexpected like that.
I love that. And of course, there was that awkward moment when you look at the capsule with Red Bull on the side and you realize that an energy drink has a better space program than your own country. But other than that, it was really awesome.
Yep.
Yeah, no, and there will be unexpected things. So we have to be aware of those as well. And yet the big trends are the big trends. And so that's the landscape we happen to be in. Do you have any final words for us on the sustainable portfolio that we haven't covered?
No, but I liked your last sentence. You can build a portfolio around the big trends, and those are the ones that you can do a buy and hold on. And then look for companies that are doing that are disruptors, or you know, like what that fella did, or you know, Silicon Valley has a lot of disruptive companies here, but it's a global phenomenon. But But first start with what am I trying to sustain, and then build from there.
What am I trying to sustain? And then we build from there. I like it. All right. Well, Bob, thank you very much. That's all the time we have today. Again, very illuminating and gave me lots to think about. And I hope our listeners got plenty to think about as well. And I'm interested in going through the, I believe your software has a proper name, doesn't it?
Well, it was coined the Octopus because it takes all this data and links it together. So we probably need a marketing person to come up with a better name, but that's what we call it.
Something better than Octopus. But right. We'll go with Octopus for the moment. So, yeah, I would like to take a tour through Octopus at some point and see what comes out of that. That would be interesting for me.
Happy to do it. It's very quick because it's literally 15, 20 minutes to get it up and running.
Well, thank you very much. This has been another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. We have been talking with Bob Fitzwilson of the Portola Group. If you want to find out anything more about Portola, the Octopus software program, or anything else, we have all of the information contained in the article that accompanies this podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And Bob, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. My pleasure.